Good evening. I thought of once again beginning, as I have on several of the previous occasions, by spinning a yarn, telling a story, and then having you try on the basis of the outline of the story to fill in the details. By the way, you know the origin of spinning a yarn. It originates from the notion that when women sat around weaving and the like, that they would pass the time, since they were able to do it almost with their eyes closed, they would pass the time just by telling stories to each other. So the notion of telling the story became associated with the spinning. So to tell the story became called to spin, and the object of the story was associated with the product, namely a yarn. Therefore, spinning a yarn came to be a figure of speech for telling the story. Telling the story is a story in itself. Since you should stop to think about it, the Hebrew equivalent of to tell a story is lesaper. Ordinarily, lispor means means to count. No, lesaper, that's lispor, is to count. Now, the relationship between counting and storytelling is not particularly clear, except that when you talk about a version of a story, you say, well, that's your account. And then all of a sudden, the proximity of Sipur and Lispor gets a little closer to each other. When you stop to think about it, the relationship is even closer than that. Although English does strange things, the person who tells the story is recounting, right? Although there's no obvious counting involved. And the person who sits in the bank and actually counts is called a teller. So there again, you see in German it comes out a little better, because in German, to count is zählen, and to tell a story is erzählen. So there is a very, very close relationship between them. In any event, I had toyed with the idea of beginning this evening, as we did with the Megillat Esther and as we did with Sefer Yonah, to try to sketch the outline of the story and to see that, in fact, the details of the story can be filled in or fleshed out from more than one location. And then I stopped and I said, wait, I'll do that, but at the same time, I should ask the question. By now, there should be some sort of growing, of notion, growing by accretion, that if indeed there are so many stories, so many plots, so many outlines in Tanakh, which can be filled in with the particular details of more than one story, to use one of Rashi's favorite phrases, Ein HaMikra HaZeh Omer Ela, Darshene. What's the significance of this? So I thought that instead of starting just right outright by telling the story, I would start first on this notion. I thought that this evening, since we're concluding, it behooves us not merely to just discuss another text, though we will, but to see whether we can't come to some sort of larger conclusions based on a lot of the texts that we've been examining. So keep that question in mind. Now tell the story, and then we'll try to come back a bit later on and to address the question of what does it mean if we can tell a story about this young man, if you remember, who was born in the land of Israel and removed forcibly and grows up in the diaspora and provides a king with life-saving, and it turns out to be both Yosef and Mordechai, and then we tell a story about a large number of people who are threatened with almost imminent destruction, and they have a 3-day fast, and they wear sackcloth and ashes, and there's a lottery involved, and it turns out to be both the story of Purim and to an extent the story of Yonah, or if we were able to match some of the details, the sketches of the story of Yonah with Eov and the like, and we'll add to it the one that we'll do this evening, to come back to ask of what significance is this. The details of this evening's story are very familiar. The setting is one of the most simple and yet one of the most impressionable stories in the in Tanakh. You know, it takes place, a pastoral scene. It involves fields, and it involves a well. And as you know, almost invariably, when in one of at least the narratives of Bereshit, if you say, well, there's a well, and there are people who are coming to draw water from the well, and there are fields, and this is all, you know, as I say, a pastoral scene, then you know that there is an almost inevitable conclusion that at this well, what's going to happen? Right? There's a guy who's going to show up on one side, and there's a girl who's going to show up on the other side, and you have the original version of guys and dolls, right? We know it from the story of Yaakov and Rachel. We know it from the story of Moshe and Tzipora. So this story fits into one of those types of stories. And again, it's a story of, you know, girl meets boy or boy meets girl. And again, the circumstances under which they meet are certainly better described by the word accidental than by anything else. As a matter of fact, the Hebrew word for accidental plays a significant role in this story. The word, or at least the verbal root, kufresh hay, right, plays a significant role in the story. While we are accustomed to the notion that if the Bible is going to tell us a story about an individual, then there is a necessary a priori assumption that this individual is important, right? Nevertheless, there is some additional significance which attaches to the story of the meeting between this man and this woman, because indeed one of them is very important, and therefore we are particularly concerned about his matrimonial prospects, because he is expected or anticipated to fill an important role in the development of a certain tradition or in the propagation of a certain clan or something like that. And again, almost once again, from our knowledge of these stories in the Bible, almost invariably, the woman is of considerably less importance, at least at the outset, than the man. Now, indeed, this man and this woman meet under this circumstance best described as accidental. And in fact, we discover subsequently that they become the new patriarch and matriarch, so to speak, of a particularly significant family. Right? Now, as I said, those details could fit several stories. If I were, however, to look at some more significant linguistic features, we would narrow it down. For example, I emphasize the appearance in both of these stories of forms of the word accident. Now, that does not appear in the story of Moshe and Tzipora. It does not appear in the story of Yaakov and Rachel. But it does appear in the other two stories which remain in this type of story. On one hand, the story of Eliezer and Rivka, where indeed part of Eliezer's prayer, where he prays to the God of Abraham, he says, Hakreina lefanai hayom. And this is what links that story to the one that we're talking about this evening, namely the story of Ruth, where her choice of the field of Boaz, in which she goes to glean, is described by Vayiker Mikreha. And again, in and of itself, this one occurrence of an interesting word in two comparable stories would not in and of itself recommend that the later one was necessarily patterned after the former. But in the case of the story of Ruth and in the case of the story of Eliezer and Rivka, the literary parallels and the linguistic parallels are so numerous that they fill up three pages of this very excellent book. Again, it may very well be that this book, which was published independently in 1981, may have subsequently been incorporated into the Da'at Mikra volume on Chamesh Megillot. It is called Eunim B'Megillat Ruth by Gavriel Chaim Kohen, whose originally separate work on Megillat Esther was incorporated into the Da'at Mikra introduction to Megillat Esther. I do not have the opportunity to check and to see whether his introduction to Ruth is incorporated into their version of it. But here we have, and that's why I decided that I'm not going to focus on this, because there are just too many of these parallels. Whereas in the story of Yosef and Megillat Esther, we saw maybe half a dozen literary parallels. We saw the striking similarities in the outline of the stories. We filled in some of the details with, for example, the phrase, V'yafked Pekidim. Yosef's advice to Paro was V'yafked Pekidim, in order to gather the grain. Description of the beauty pageant in Shushan has the king, V'yafked HaMelech Pekidim B'chol Medinot Malachuto. We saw about half a dozen such literary parallels, because in the story of Yosef we didn't need more than half a dozen literary parallels, because the narrative parallels were so striking. Here, the narrative parallels are less striking only because we know of at least two other biblical stories which fit some of the additional details, but the literary parallels here are remarkable. Taken together, the numerous literary parallels and the substantial similarity in the narrative framework, we once again come to a reasonable and legitimate conclusion that the writers of Megillat Ruth made a deliberate attempt to pattern not the story of Ruth, but their description of the story of Ruth after the earlier description of the story of the encounter of Eliezer and Rivka, leading us to the conclusion that they saw in the story of Boaz and Ruth a very, very clear and distinct analogy to the earlier story of Yitzchak and Rivka. And as in the story of Mordechai and Yosef, we will assume that there is more to it than just the coincidence of two stories happening the same way. As I said, you can take coincidence only so far. You can say that, well, listen, in those days, the well was like the, I don't know, where do people meet today? I know that in the holy city of Jerusalem, the favorite meeting place for single young men and women interested in making each other's acquaintance are the lobbies of five-star hotels, especially on Thursday nights, and especially in the last couple of years, they tell me, since the infamous Richie's Pizza closed down. But you can say that in the biblical period, the well was the place where, you know, young people got together. They would be there anyway during the course of the day's business, since the course of the day's business for most of them consisted of tending to their flocks. And therefore, it was a place where they would come to socialize. And therefore, what is so surprising about the fact that from time to time, a young man and a young woman would meet? Now, of course, you say, then wait a second. If it's such a common thing, then it deserves no attention whatsoever. So then you point out, yes, well, in these biblical stories, which focus upon the well as the meeting ground between a man and a woman, there's a difference. The man and the woman are not from the same town. Yes, that boys and girls or young men and young women from the same town would meet at the town well, would become acquainted with each other, and would inevitably end up marrying each other, is far too trite to deserve any description. But that the well served as a meeting point for local people to make the acquaintance of strangers, and that it happened frequently that strangers would meet their life mates at a well, that perhaps occurred with considerably less frequency, and therefore it could become a type scene for a biblical story. So then it isn't just the fact that Ruth happened to meet Boaz in a field. Again, it's not at a well per se, although there's the matter of drawing water from the well, which comes up in their conversation. Boaz does say to her, "Vitzamit, that if you thirsty, that you can take the water that is drawn by the young men." But the fact that they meet in a pastoral setting is in and of itself not necessarily the coincidence, but that the author of Megillat Rut drew deliberately upon the language of Sefer Breshit in describing this, as though he didn't want to say, well, here comes another boy meets girl story, but rather as though he wanted to say, pay careful attention, here comes another one of those very singular stories in which a person who is fated to become the progenitor of a particularly significant clan or tribe or kingdom or something of that sort meets a woman whom he would ordinarily not have met, and who furthermore is not merely a stranger in terms of geographic proximity, but is a stranger in an even more significant fashion, an alien. An alien, right? Let's be cautious and careful about the use of the word alien, especially in the post-Star Trek era. By stranger, I mean someone with whom you're not acquainted, but with whom you could theoretically become acquainted under circumstances. If your town and the neighboring town went together into the nearest city for the market day, right, then you could encounter a stranger, somebody from a neighboring town with whom you were not previously acquainted. But in the case of Rivka, Rivka is not merely a stranger to Yitzchak. She is alien in the sense that she comes from a different country, from a different tribe, from a different nation. Tzipporah is not merely a stranger to Moshe. She is alien to Moshe. She is not Jewish, not even Egyptian, but Midianite. Right? Rachel is an interesting one. While related to Yaakov, right, at that moment, prior to his making her personal acquaintance, she was again not merely a stranger, but effectively alien. And so it is with Boaz and Ruth, because at the moment that they meet, she is an alien. Now, here I've already crossed the line. She doesn't know who Boaz is. That was the accident. See, that was the Viyiker Mikreha. She chooses the field not because she knows who Boaz is. Wait. No. Viyiker Mikreha Chelkat HaSadeh Asher LeBoaz Asher MiMishpachat Elimelech. She doesn't know this yet. When she returns at the end of the day, and she says, Shem HaIsh Asher Asiti Imo Hayom Boaz, only then does Naomi say to her, whoa! You know what the Yiddish word bashert means, right? That's what Naomi says. She says bashert, right? Karov lanu ha'ish migo'aleinu hu. Ruth doesn't know. Boaz doesn't know who she is. Yes, when he turns to somebody and he says, who's that? And they say, na'ara mo'aviyahi hashava im Naomi misdei Moav. Of course, he's heard the story. So then he knows who she is, but she's up to that point in time, and as I said, where I crossed the line and where I thought somebody might challenge me, is that I made a deliberate point of saying that when Eliezer met Rivka, Eliezer in this case is merely acting as the agent of Yitzchak, right? When Eliezer meets Rivka, she is not merely a stranger, but an alien. She is of a different tribe, of a different nation, and I hesitate to say of a different religion, because I'm not 100% sure of what religion Yitzchak was. I'm never sure, and I'm constantly asking my students for enlightenment on the subject as to who was actually the first Jew. For the moment, you just want to know who the three leading candidates are. The three leading candidates for the first Jew are Avraham Avinu, Moshe Rabbeinu, and Adam HaRishon. Adam HaRishon. Those are the three leading candidates. I think that there's a dark horse. There's a dark horse, because it depends on what your definition is of a Jew. See, if a Jew must translate as a Yehudi, then clearly neither Adam HaRishon nor Avraham Avinu could have been Yehudim, in any event. I made the point that Tzipora, not merely was she not Jewish and not Egyptian, she was Midianite. And that Rachel too, while being a relative of Yaakov, was of a different tribe, of a different nation, and of a different religion. If I now want to place the story of Boaz and Ruth within that context, I am suggesting then that when they met, if she was an alien, then she was not Jewish. And I thought that somebody would challenge me on the grounds that when Ruth said to Naomi, Amech ami ve'elohayich Elohai, that do we not assume that at that moment she converted? So even if she is a stranger to Boaz, she is not at that moment as alien to Boaz as Tzipora was to Moshe and Rachel to Yaakov and Rivka to Yitzchak. Which then would give me the opportunity, but though nobody asked me, I don't know whether I'm obligated to say it, would give me the opportunity to point out that there's a difference between what Ruth says in Perek Aleph to Naomi and what Ruth actually does in Perek Gimel under Naomi's direction. When Naomi directs her, V'rachatz, V'asacht, V'samtzim lotayich alayich, it is at that point that the Midrash and some of the Parshanim suggest that the rachatz there is not just an ordinary rechitza of ta'anug, but that actually constituted her tevilah. That the statement of Amecha mi ve'elohayich Elohai may have constituted the prerequisite of Kabbalat Ol Malachut Shamayim, of the indication of an inclination towards conversion, but that conversion cannot be accomplished simply by an oral declaration. Therefore, the act of Rechitza is assumed to have been an act of Tevilah, and that is assumed to have been the actual conversion. Okay. We've covered a lot of details, but not in a systematic or methodical fashion. Let's come now to the text itself and try to approach it somewhat more systematically. There is a good deal of scholarly literature on Megillat Rut for a variety of reasons. Some of it devoted to the content and the balance devoted to the form. The content of Megillat Rut fascinates many Bible scholars, many of whom, could even be most, but I haven't done a head count, many of whom are convinced that Megillat Rut must be dated in the Second Temple period, and that it is some sort of a polemical response to the crisis concerning the foreign wives. We know that during the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, there was a crisis when the people were turned out to have married Gentile women, and they had to send them away and then retake them if they wished, and that this perhaps was some sort of polemical response to that, saying, what's so bad with foreign women? Right, and therefore somebody wrote a book emphasizing the fact that the ancestress of King David was one of these foreign women. Right, because remember that those women then are not merely just foreign in the sense of being non-Jewish, they are described somewhat particularly as being Moaviot. You know, what's wrong with Moaviot? You know, what's wrong? Here, Ruth was a Moaviah. So that the content intrigues a lot of people. They speculate over what appears to be a reference to Yibum is or isn't. That's very easy to answer. It isn't. They speculate over the appearance of the issue of Geulat Karkaot, but their concern is with the content. Others deal primarily with the form, and they are totally captivated by the narrative art of Megillat Rut. It is, in effect, one of the most perfect short stories ever written. If you take out a handbook and find a description of a short story, what are the qualities or characteristics of a fine, of an outstanding short story, Rut meets every one of those criteria. It has every one of those characteristics. I opened the handbook, right? And I read. It says what a short story should have. First, the first, and I think, this again, a totally unprofessional opinion, I think that the sine qua non of a short story, I mean, the most singular and necessary characteristic is that it must be short. It is, right? This is a very, very short story, okay? And yet somehow within that relatively short expanse of time or space, there has to be action. There has to be the development of at least one character, right? And there have to be, it would be helpful if there were also moments of suspense in the action. So that if you have action, and you have suspense so that periodically you're given cause to wonder about whether everything is going to turn out the way you have been led to imagine that it will turn out, and if while following the course of the action you have the opportunity to observe the interaction between two interesting personalities and to see those personalities grow as a result of this interaction, and if all of this can take place within a reasonably short amount of time or space, then you have an effective short story. And indeed you have it here in Megillat Rut, and in fact, it's very curious that the arrangement of Megillat Rut into numerical chapters happens to suit the pace of the action. Every one of the chapters of Megillat Rut can constitute a scene in this basically one-act play, or if you prefer, four separate acts. I don't really remember that much of what they tried to teach me in high school about the difference between those things. But as a matter of fact, what I often do with high school students in studying Megillat Rut is I encourage them to read the story, and then I say to them, imagine that this story is being aired on television, right, on a one-hour made-for-TV movie, and ordinarily in the course of a one-hour made-for-TV movie, there's room for four commercial spots. Where in the story would you place the commercials? So that, of course, is an intriguing question because you wonder about where, in fact, do you interrupt the story? Do you interrupt the story before you reach the climactic point? Or do you allow the climax to appear and then you interrupt the story? Now, if you take the story of Rut, you have chapter 1, which is the story of Naomi and her daughters-in-law. Chapter 2 can be called Rut and Boaz, the meeting in the field. Chapter 3, of course, is called either the tryst, or just simply Rut and Boaz by moonlight, or if you prefer, just simply the goren, right? And the fourth chapter, it can very well be called the denouement, or do you want to call it the happily ever after? Right? Now, if you look carefully, each one, at least of the first three chapters, does in fact leave us hanging on a note of suspense. The action throughout each chapter lulls us into what the end of the chapter makes appear to be a false sense of complacency. The first chapter opens up as Naomi, who is in Moab, as we know, and has been decimated by the loss of her husband and the loss of her sons, and don't even want to get into the question of whether the names Machlon and Chilion, whether anybody could have imagined that we would assume that they are historical names, or whether these are names that don't just cry out, jump off the page and say, you know, figurative, right? And she goes, and Rut leaves, Orpah leaves her, and Rut doesn't. And that's a shining note. We're given a note of optimism, right? Here, finally, there's some sort of solace, some sort of consolation for Naomi. Ruth is sticking by her. And yet, how does the chapter end? The chapter ends with the words, right? Anim le'ah halachti v'rekam heshivani Hashem. Lama tikren ali Naomi v'Hashem anavi v'shadai heirali. Meaning, we're led along the garden path, and there's a thorn bush in the way. Chapter 2 starts off. We get the story, the encounter of Ruth and Boaz, and we're saying to ourselves, thank goodness, Naomi is about to have some genuine Yiddish nachas. Right? Here's Ruth, here's Boaz, you know, he's impressed with her. She surely can't help but to be impressed with him. He seems to be a wealthy landowner, right? He's taken an interest in her. And once again, we're being led down the path. And in store once again, at the end of chapter 2, is another, call it either disappointment, right? And that is, Vatidbak b'na'arot Boaz lilaket. So on one hand, Ruth perseveres. She continues to return day after day to the field of Boaz in order to enjoy the conditions which he has set up for her. But notice, there's already a little insinuation there. Day after day, day after day. There's this little insinuation of timelessness, whereas the whole sense of the book is that we're running out of time. And the closing words, Ad klot k'tzir ha-se'orim u'k'tzir ha-chitim, an extended period of time, but the worst part of the last three words, Vateshev et chamota, right? She still lives at home with her mother-in-law. Perek Gimel gives us once again, it's like every perek we have to start anew. It's as though we have to come out of a depression. And Ruth once again makes this valiant try, right? The valiant attempt to, let's call it for what it is, to seduce Boaz, right, into proposing marriage to her. And we get the sense that now finally, even we assume up until now that it's Boaz's fault, that he's the reluctant party in this match. Now finally Boaz seems to be moving, and yet there's still another surprise or disappointment in store for us. And look again at the closing phrase, Shvi Viti. With all that the word shave implies, it is the total antithesis of action. The total antithesis of action. In fact, here, shavi is particularly antithetical to the phrase, to a word which marked very much of the opening chapter, which was lashuv. Even lashuv is active, but shave is totally passive. But it's Shvi viti, right? Inert, remain inert, inactive. Ad asher teda'in ech yipol davar, ki lo yishkot ha'ish kim kila davar ayom. He says to her, he says, Jesus, I'd love to take care of everything right now, but it's out of my hands. Now we're even more disappointed than we were before. We've gotten to the point where Boaz meets Ruth. We've gotten to the point where, to use a trite phrase, they've fallen in love. And we're still going nowheres. We're shvi. We're inert, inactive, and the initiative has been taken out of our hands entirely. So that, as I said, it does indeed have several characteristics or criteria which bespeak an excellently crafted story. And the characters? Who's the principal character of the book? Ooh, gee, that's a tough one. You know? I know it's called Megillat Rut. That would seem to indicate that she's the principal character, but is she the principal character or is she merely the heroine? She's clearly the heroine. I don't dispute that. But is she really the principal actor in the story? Or is the principal actor in the story Naomi, who directs or perhaps even manipulates Ruth and even Boaz, for that matter? Now, I found an interesting midrash which set me thinking. It appears in Rut Rabbah. Amar Rabbi Zaira, Megillazo, Ein ba lo tuma'a velo tahora, lo isur velo heter. So, lama nichtava. What function in Kitvei Kodesh is served by a book which, in spite of all that recommends it as a short story, seems to offer has no religious or spiritual dimension? There's neither tumah v'tahara, nor isur v'heter, v'lama nichtava. And his answer is, l'lamdecha kama sachar tov legomle chasadim. To teach us the recompense for gemilot chasadim. All of a sudden something resonated. Chesed. Chesed. Isn't there chesed in the story? Now, with Eliezer and Avraham, there is chesed, because part again of that tefillah of Eliezer, right, is Aseh chesed im Adoni Avraham. And indeed, if I said to you, how would you describe Rivka? A young woman, right, who offers to draw water for a stranger and for his camels, right? How would you describe that? Surely you would say chesed. Now, how would you describe Ruth, who cleaves, right? And that's a significant word here, vatidbak, right? Who cleaves to her mother-in-law in order, as it were, to help her mother-in-law keep together the shattered pieces of her life, and who abandons her own father and mother, her own country, her own birthplace. Sound familiar? Does it sound familiar? Vata'azvi avi ve'imech ve'eretz moladetech v'telechi el am asher lo yada'at tmol shilshom. Does that strike any kind of resonant chord? Lech lecha me'artzecha mi'moladetecha mi'beit avicha el ha'aretz asher ar'eka. But in the more interpersonal sense than the theological sense, would we not describe Ruth as Ruth's activities as chesed? But it isn't. Chesed isn't only here by way of description. Chesed is here by way of literary design. We have it first in Perek Aleph Pasuk Chet. Ya'as Hashem imachem chesed. Kasher asitem im hametim ve'imadi. Right? Naomi's bracha to her daughters-in-law. Right? You have clearly indicated a desire to perform chesed with me. May you be deserving of chesed yourselves. But that isn't the only chesed. In Perek Bet, we find that Boaz says to, I'm sorry, that Naomi says to Ruth in Pasuk Kaf, speaking of Boaz, Baruch Hu Lashem Asher Lo Azav Chasdo Et HaChayim Ve'et HaMetim. Right? That Boaz performs perpetual acts of chesed, both on behalf of the living as well as on behalf of the late departed. By the way, this phrase, Asher lo azav chasdo, right, is an echo of Breishit Perek Kaf Dalet, that same story of Eliezer and Rivka, Pasuk Kaf Zayin, where part of Eliezer's prayer, his prayer of thanksgiving to the God of Avraham, is Asher lo azav chasdo me'im Adoni. So now what do we have? We have Naomi, who wishes for Ruth chesed. We have Boaz, who is described as a man of chesed. In Perek Gimel, Pasuk Yod, Boaz says to Ruth, Berucha at Lashem biti, hetavd chasdeich ha'acharon min harishon. So what do we find? The man of chesed meets his bashert, the woman of chesed, as though fulfilling the bracha of chesed which was given by Naomi. And along with this, there's another match, another literary match, which is made here. In Perek Bet Pasuk Aleph, Boaz is described as an ish gibor chayil. In Perek Gimel, Pasuk Yod Aleph, Boaz describes Ruth as an eshet chayil. It's almost like reading the singles column in the Jewish week. Man of chesed, known as gibor chayil, seeks Eshet Chayil, also Chesed, right? You know, for what? No, to make more Chayil, because we get it once again in Perek Dalet, Pasuk Yod Aleph, when the man of Chesed and the woman of Chesed marry, and the Gibor Chayil has his Eshet Chayil, the words on everybody's lips in Beit Lechem is Va'aseh Chayil. As though we know that the union of a Gibor Chayil and an Eshet Chayil must necessarily produce, that's literally, La'lechet mi Chayil el Chayil. Now, there are other significant words which have the effect here of describing relationships. You know that one of the principles to which biblical narrative adheres is that it is singularly circumspect when it comes to describing our physical characteristics and even imputing psychological motives. I may have mentioned this on a previous occasion. If not, I mention it now, and if I have it, it certainly warrants repetition. A wonderful description of this quality of biblical narrative was given by Erich Auerbach, a German Jew who escaped from Germany, made his way to Constantinople, where he sat, and without benefit of books, without benefit of sources, sat and wrote a remarkable book on literature called Mimesis. Mimesis, on the representation of reality in literature, in which the opening chapter is entitled Odysseus's Scar. And his purpose in this chapter is to contrast the richness of physical detail and of psychological motive in the Homeric epics on one hand, to the total absence of either physical detail or psychological motive, not just from the Bible in general, but from what one particularly significant biblical narrative, namely Akedat Yitzchak. So we know that this is a characteristic feature of biblical narrative. And yet, what we need to know about people's feelings towards each other is revealed, but it is revealed in the indirect fashion, obliquely, through either the narrator or through their own words. For example, the story in Bereshit Perek Kaf Aleph, in which I have the habit of calling Akedat Yishmael. Right? It's another one of those interesting things, right? Remember, we still have to come back to this notion of why there are so many stories that fit the same external description, right? Patriarch has an only son, and he's commanded to effectively jeopardize his life, right? In that story, Yishmael is described three different ways, depending upon who is relating to him. Whenever Sarah speaks about Yishmael, he is always described as Ben Ha'amahazot. Right? Whenever Avraham speaks about Yishmael, he becomes Bini. So that what we need to know about the interrelationships amongst these people is given us not because there is some narrative preface saying Sarah was this and Abraham was that, but we Vatomer la Naomi chamota bt. Notice the narrator continues to describe their relationship quite correctly and quite properly as the relationship between the mother-in-law and the daughter-in-law. The words Vatomer Naomi el Rut Kalata are the narrator's words. The words Vatomer Lah Naomi Chamota are the narrator's words. But the words Naomi begins to use are Biti, Biti. So that we can see these relationships growing, these relationships emerging. So much so that what's the conclusion of the fact? Vatavol Chamota Vatomer Miat Biti, Vatomer Shvi Biti. What's the result of this? The result of this is that when a child is finally born to Rut, there becomes the almost total merging of their two personalities. Naomi has moved from being the mother-in-law to being the mother to being virtually identical with the daughter or daughter-in-law, so that what do people go around saying? Yulad Bein l'Naomi. The almost merging, the almost total identity of the characters. What else did I jot down here? We touched those things. We touched on all these things. There is in Pasuk Yod Gimel, if I'm not mistaken, in Perek Aleph, right? Yeah, but that's brought about, that you can see that she's moved. That's a momentary thing. She's touched by the willingness of these two Moabite young women to accompany her. And therefore, when she turns to them and she says, Lechna b'notai shovna, that's not because she really feels that she has an actual mother-daughter relationship with them. I think this is just a moment of intimacy that is brought about by this very, very touching situation. And if not, so it begins then rather than beginning only later. But I think that the merging of the characters and of the personalities certainly occurs by the end of the story. Now, the essential quality then of Rut is the ability of the author to see tragedy, drama, and the kind of heroism even in the drab realities of everyday life. And he utilizes the problems of everyday life to produce dramatic tensions, which are resolved by human decency, by chesed. And I read one quotation that I found in one of the commentaries, and that will be the transition into the final phase. It is a rather simple expansion, mostly by longish speeches, that provides the Book of Ruth with its necessary size and apparent, rather than real, complexity. since it had to stand by itself, so to speak, meaning it's an independent book in the Bible, it had to be expanded to suitable size. Meaning he's saying, you know something he's saying? This whole story could really be told in one chapter. In one chapter. In fact, if you see the focus of the story being not the story of Boaz and Ruth, but actually just being the ancestry of David, you could actually imagine the story being told in three or four psukim. As it came time to introduce David HaMelech, right, as the son of Yishai mi Beit Lechem, there could be a little pasuk which says, V'Yishai, right, V'Yishai hu asher nolad le'oved ben Boaz, asher nasa le'isha et Rut HaMoaviyah hashava in Naomi misdei Moav, or something like that. As a matter of fact, what the question which it calls to my mind is, Taka, why isn't it just a perek? A perek in which sefer? In which sefer of Tanakh would this story fit in on account of its pastoral setting, on account of the simplicity of its narrative? Where would it fit in so well that if in fact it comprised a chapter in this book rather than an independent book, no one would ever know? Not Shmuel, but Shoftim. Shoftim. As a matter of fact, the Baraita, to which we have referred on several occasions, which ascribes the different books of Tanakh to different authors or editors, credits Shmuel, the author of Shoftim and Shmuel, with the authorship of the book of Ruth. Raising the intriguing question, so if you're already writing a book, Shoftim, in which this story fits, doesn't it say at the beginning, Vayhi Bimei Shvot HaShoftim? Is there not an Agadic tradition which identifies Boaz as one of the Shoftim, right? Iv Tzan Mi Beit Lechem, it's kind of like the mathematical formula, right? If A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C. Boaz was from Beit Lechem, and Ivtzan was from Beit Lechem, ergo Ivtzan must be Boaz. But therefore, why, Shmuel, did you write Megillat Ruth as a separate entity rather than just incorporating the story of Ruth into one of your existing books? It would fit very well, both literarily and thematically, either into Shoftim or into Shmuel. What justifies Ruth, as this person said, standing alone? If you think about it, this question can be asked about one other book of Tanakh, which in fact has something else in common with Ruth. It's a Megillah, which similarly, according to Chazal, was written by somebody to whom they also ascribed two other books. Echa. Yirmiyahu wrote Sefer Melachim, comparable to Shmuel writing Sefer Shoftim. Yirmiyahu wrote Sefer Yirmiyahu, comparable to Shmuel writing Sefer Shmuel. And just as Shmuel wrote Ruth, Yirmiyahu also wrote Echa. Why is Echa a book by itself rather than comprising several chapters in the book of Yirmiyahu? Or being a postscript to Sefer Melachim. Sefer Melachim effectively ends on the note of the Churban. So say it was destroyed, and then go into Echa Yashva Vadad. And don't tell me that's because one is poetry and one is prose, right? If that were the case, we would have to excise Shirat Dvorah from Shoftim. We would have to remove Shirat Hayam from Sefer Shmot. We'd have to remove Ha'azinu and Dezot HaBaracha. Right? And tell me, well, that's different. See, Ha'azinu is only one perek, right? And Shirat Hayam is only one perek, and Echa is four prakim. Don't wash. We have two effectively identical situations. where two Nevi'im are credited each with three books, one of which is effectively a historical book. The other is somewhat historical, also somewhat prophetic. And the third is a Megillah. Why are Rut and Eicha separate books in Tanakh rather than being part of one of the other two books written or edited by the same authors? What is their singular characteristic or quality, one which hopefully, in order to be a good explanation, it ought to fit both of them? Right? Is there, in fact, some characteristic shared by Rut and Eicha which we can contrast to shared characteristics of Shoftim and Melachim, Shemuel and Yirmiyahu, which would enable us to understand not so much about why Shmuel and Yirmiyahu wrote them separately, because I couldn't tell you right now that they did write them separately, but at the very least, why the people who were responsible for the canonization of Tanakh canonized them independently. And I think that the answer, it's sometimes easier to answer it when I start from Eicha, but since we're dealing with Rut, I'll start from that end. Why was Sefer Rut written? Was it really written, as Rabbi Zeira claims, Lahagid Lelamdecha Kama Sachar Tov Legomlei Chasadim? Would that justify its inclusion in Tanakh? Probably not, if that were the only thing it had going for it, because there are stories of other Gomlei Chasadim in Tanakh. Right? If there were no instance in Tanakh of a Gomel Chasadim receiving Sachar, you need one. But you have such stories. So what is the additional quality or virtue of Rut which recommended it to be written in the first place, let alone to be canonized? That's too meta. Too meta. But what's the practical result of all of that meta? It's right here in the book. You have to work to get it, because it's the last word. What's the last word in the Megillah? That's right. David. It seems to me that in fact the one detail which legitimates the story biblically doesn't need it to be legitimated otherwise. It's a beautiful story, right? And it's a beautiful story with a lovely moral. But what legitimates it biblically is David. Now, it would seem then to make sense to me that Shmuel, whether he was aware of the story or not aware of the story earlier in his life, would have had no reason to record the story, or to go back to where we started tonight, to recount the story, until he met David. Right? Because no David, no story. I mean, Shmuel, as I say, it's arguable whether Shmuel learned the story only after he was directed to David, as though Shmuel, having been told by God that David is going to succeed Shaul, did a Dun and Bradstreet on him, so to speak, in order to find out. Remember the question that Shaul asks when David steps forth to fight Goliath? This crazy question, Ben mi zeh ha'ish, right? Kind of looking into his antecedents. So it's possible on one hand that Shmuel knew nothing about the story until he was directed to Beit Lechem, directed to David, and then launched some sort of a little, you know, quiet, confidential inquiry into who is this person, are there any bones rattling around in his closet, or are they going to get him on the nanny business, right? To use one of our contemporary little things, right? Or it's possible that if Boaz, in fact, was one of the Shoftim, then it's somewhat inconceivable that Shmuel would not have known this story long before he met David. But even if he had known the story, it's unlikely that he would have recorded the story, let alone have considered it worthy of inclusion in Kitvei Kodesh, because As a Gomel Chasadim story, he didn't need it. As a Shoftim story, he didn't need it. So it was only after he met David and said, now I know, that in retrospect the story took on biblical legitimation. Now, what then is different about Shmuel's authorship of Rut from his authorship of Shoftim and Shmuel? Because there's one additional difference. One additional difference. We at least subscribe nominally to the notion that the books in Ketuvim constitute a different order of Kedusha than the books which are in Nevi'im. Exactly what that is an open question. The standard answer that all my students know is that books in Nevi'im were written b'nevu'ah, and books in Ketuvim were written only b'ruach HaKodesh. First thing is that it seems that nobody ever suggested this until the Middle Ages. There is no Talmudic or Midrashic source for this. It appears first during the time of the Rishonim. Second thing is, that to my mind would make this question even crazier. So you're telling me that Shmuel was enough of a Navi to write Shoftim and Shmuel, but all of a sudden when it came to Little Rut, no Nevuah anymore. Yirmiyahu was enough in the Navi to write Melachim and Yirmiyahu, but all of a sudden, when it comes to Little Eicha, no Navi anymore. In fact, my solution to this conundrum actually supplies a distinction between Nevi'im and Ketuvim, which is not dependent upon the source of inspiration. To use the yeshiva terminology when trying to distinguish between something which is inherent in the individual involved as opposed to something which inheres in the object, the difference between the gavra and the cheftza, I think that the difference between the Nevi'im and Ketuvim does not inhere in the gavra. It's not a function of the prophet or the source of his inspiration, but inheres rather in the literary product. There is, I think, a very, very clear and significant difference between Shoftim, Shmuel, Yirmiyahu, Melachim on one hand, and Eicha and Rut on the other hand. Eicha is Yirmiyahu's personal response to the tragedy of the Chorban. Melachim and Yirmiyahu are equally responsive to the tragedy, but they're not personal. When Yirmiyahu compiled Sefer Melachim and wrote Sefer Yirmiyahu, he was acting as a Navi. Because you know what the word Navi literally means? The word Navi literally means a spokesman, an interlocutor, an intermediary. When Shmuel was writing Shoftim and Shmuel, he wasn't writing it personally. He was writing it in fulfillment of his mission as a Navi to report on the early history of the Jewish people leading up to the establishment of the monarchy. So when Yirmiyahu responded to the tragedy of the Chorban with Eicha, this was the same Navi Yirmiyahu. It's not as though Yirmiyahu had days on which he felt good, so he was a Navi, and on other days he woke up on the wrong side of the bed, so he only had Ruach HaKodesh. I don't like that. I think that the difference is that when Yirmiyahu wrote something in fulfillment of his divinely ordained mission to be the agent of God or the representative of the Jewish people to record the history of the Jewish people at a particular moment in time, then that book was recognized as a function of a national mission and is in Nevi'im. Whereas when that same Yirmiyahu wrote a book which was inspired equally, but reflected his personal feelings and his personal reaction to the Chorban, it was not considered to be on a lower level of inspiration, but it was considered instead to belong to a different category of literature. they are his personal response or they are descriptive of his personal circumstances. Of course, and Yeshayahu says, Zoili ki nidmeti. I don't mean that the Nevi'im were necessarily constrained to write about themselves in the third person. What I mean is that what constitutes the Rov Minyan u'Binyan of Shmuel Shoftim on one hand, along with Yirmiyahu Malachim, is that they are written in the fulfillment of a national mission or task of reporting on the history of the Jewish people. They're not devoid of personal response or personal feelings. That's not the only criterion. Yes, I agree. If that were the only criterion, I don't think it's the only criterion. As I said, I'm offering it primarily as a substitute for what I find to be an indistinct attempt at drawing the line between different gradations of prophetic inspiration. I agree. No, as I said, it's not perfectly clear. As I say, it's not as though I set myself the task of trying to articulate a theology of canonization. What I started with are these discordant notes in the canonical process. That here we have Nevi'im, Shmuel and Yirmiyahu, and each of them wrote two big books which are considered part of Nevi'im. How then do you account for the fact that each of them is also considered to have been the author of a third book, and those third books are not part of the Nevi'im, but are part of Ketuvim? By all means. So have only one perek of it represented. I don't know. It says of Shlomo, Vayhi Shiro Merav Ha'elef, and we don't have all of them. Agreed. I think it's an attempt at trying to account for the phenomena. With respect,
we have to think of Megillat Ruth in different hands. Maybe it's an allegory that it's a different approach to telling a very important story about how Israel or about whatever. Then maybe there is something more to it that would justify more fully that it was written separately and not put into just the end.
It's possible, but I think that the redemptive note of Ruth is there at the end. I think it actually is. I see no problem with saying that the legitimating or redemptive note of Ruth is in fact the word David. I think that David was enough to command attention of Chazal, enough to command. Look, as I said, if Shlomo had 1,000 shirim, and we report on, we have one, right? So how does David end up with 150 mizmorei tehillim? So you say, genug. This got to reach a point. So you say, David wrote tehillim, lovely. You imagine David wrote only 150 tehillim? I'm assuming for a moment David wrote all of them. I don't actually assume that. But even assuming that David wrote all 150 mizmorim of tehillim, what are we supposed to say? We're supposed to assume that this is, it's because it says, Kalut Tfilot David ben Yishai, this is it, no more? Or do we assume that just as Shlomo had many shirim, and these are some of them, many mishalim, and these are some of them, so David had many, 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 many mizmorim, and these are some of them. But how do you account for the fact that David is represented by 150 mizmorim, and Shlomo by only... a small amount of shirim. I'm
not sure that Shlomo's shirim of the shalim were worthy of being part of the
Oh, that's, 100%, 100%.
And busy with so many other things that the rabbi's not happy with, or none of us happy with. We don't know if he's willing, maybe there are, I mean, we're not sure what those are.
100%, but David is more than that. David is not merely in his own lifetime and afterwards a charismatic figure. David is a charismatic figure. He's a mystical figure. His name is bound up perpetually and inextricably with the whole notion of messianism. I think that say David HaMelech in the presence of the people who were responsible for the canonization of Tanakh, and it was like saying open sesame. Look, among the people who were responsible for the canonization, wherever and whenever it took place, surely among them were the Nisiim. And the Nisiim were Baalei Davar when it came to David HaMelech. You recall the rebuke in the Gemara in Shabbat with discussion Kol Omer David Chatai Eino Ela Toa, right? And the suggestion that the person who maintained that had a particular interest in maintaining that. No. That's not why I mentioned it. That's not why I mentioned it. No. I mentioned it only because it's Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. No, I mentioned it only because I said, whoever and whenever was responsible for the canonization of Tanakh, the Nisiyim were among them, say David HaMelech to them, and as I said, it just opened doors. So I'm suggesting it would not, to my mind, be... Let me just, Rabbi, just one thing. No. Forget. I mentioned that not to have anything to do with the substance of the remark of David, only to point out that there were figures who played seminal roles, significant roles in the canonization process, who were obsessed with David HaMelech. I don't mean to get it all into the substance of that passage. I meant it only by a way of passing reference to their preoccupation with or obsession with David HaMelech. There's a passage in Shir HaShirim Rabbah. At the beginning of Shir HaShirim Rabbah. Terrible, terrible passage. The one that says that when the Chachamim sat down to formulate the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, in Perek Chelek, of who has a share in Olam Haba and who does not have a share in Olam Haba, right? And when they said, Shlosha Malachim V'arba'a Hedyotot Ein Lam Chelek L'Olam Haba, there's a passage in Shir HaShirim Rabbah that says that they wanted to say Arba'a Malachim. And that they wanted to commit Shlomo as a person who had no chelek in Olam Haba. And why did that not happen? Because of David HaMelech. So I'm only suggesting that if indeed the preservation of Sefer Rut as an independent element in Tanakh was due only to the connection established at the very, very end of the book with David HaMelech, I would not be surprised.
I think the last part of an Avenger, I don't think it's part of the really upsetting. Personally, I feel it doesn't fit with the rest of the book. And it's 81st, to me, it's too radical Avenger. To me, it's just too striking. Personally, I think that it does have a lot of substance and coherence. And the last sentences, I think, were just created because of the preoccupation with Tabriz, and they made it all fit into Tabriz. I think that was not the original Nebu'ah, not necessarily the original Nebu'ah.
Exactly. I agree. And I wonder then, going back to the question of the point at which Shmuel became aware of the story, the point at which he became aware of the story, one could even speculate as to whether up until that point, Shmuel had actually written it as the story of a shofet, or a story of Bimei Shofot HaShoftim, and that when he was introduced to David, he, so to speak, called up the Boaz file, right, and then added this as his own, postscript. But absolutely, it certainly conveys the sense and gives one the feeling that this is an addendum to it.
But he hasn't told us yet.
I'm going to. In fact, it's a bit of an anticlimax. The notion of stories, of where storylines recur, and where the details in certain structured stories can be filled in from a variety of different places, makes a point large and small. The large part of the point we actually discussed in detail apropos of Megillat Esther and the story of Yosef, in terms of making it abundantly clear that even things which appear on the surface to be coincidental, that is to say, to be out of the control of the principal participants, in fact turn out in retrospect to have been part of some predetermined or pre-design. The small point that it makes is the formula which is utilized to describe such phenomena, and that is Ma'aseh Avot Siman Levanim. And Ma'aseh Avot Siman Levanim, you know, you still can't shake it. You say, you know, but still, if two stories happen the same way, then why is it Ma'aseh Avot Siman Levanim? So there's a double answer. Because Ma'aseh Avot Siman Levanim incorporates two elements. One element is the Ma'aseh, the deed of the Avot. That may or may not be duplicated by the children. The second element is the one called Siman. The Siman consists not only of the original deed, but the Siman, more particularly, consists of the way the original deed is reported and recorded. When we find later biblical authors making deliberate attempts to describe later biblical events in terms which they borrow from those earlier events, then we have the confluence of both elements. It is a Ma'aseh Avot which is being repeated, but it is being repeated in the form of a Siman Levanim. When Banim make the effort to emulate their Avot, not only in deed, but in word as well as in deed, then in fact we have a glimpse into the future of Vaheshiv Lev Avot al Banim Velev Banim al Avotam. That I think is a suitable moral and certainly a suitable note on which to end this series. As I said, it perhaps was because, if I'm assuming the same reason for both, if my reasoning is correct that Eichai is separate because it was not Yirmiyahu writing in fulfillment of his national mission to capture the history of the Jewish people, but on a more personal level, then we have to say that when Shmuel wrote Rut, it was in fact perhaps in defense of David HaMelech. In defense of the point that you raised, the notion of tikkun, how can you have Melech Yisrael who is descended of Moavim, to make the point of Amoni velo Amonit, Moavi velo Moaviyah, but that in doing that, it was more of a personal effort at public relations on the part of Shmuel than it was Shmuel once again in fulfillment of his mission to capture the national history of the Jewish people. But at the moment that is the explanation that I have found most suitable. It doesn't mean that I'm completely satisfied with it, but it means that I am satisfied with it more than I have been satisfied with other explanations that I've tried. Thank you also very much for your presence and for your participation. It, I'd be delighted. I have some rather distinctive thoughts on the subject. I will even tell you that I draw them primarily from one singular interpretation of Rashi. One singular interpretation of Rashi. I'll even tell you where. No secret. This is Torah. Vayishma et hakol middaber elav me'al hakaporet. Look at Rashi on middaber. It is a singular Rashi. You know, Rashi is not ordinarily known as a person who engaged in philosophical speculation or somebody who had an active or systematic concern with theological matters. And yet on the word middaber, Rashi makes a rather remarkable theological statement. And it is based not entirely upon that, but that is one of my, so to speak, proof texts for my own ideas on the subject.